She realized she was trembling. Could this possibly be that truth her grandfather had wanted to tell her? That her family was murdered? What did she truly know about the crash that took her family? Only sketchy details. Even the stories in the newspaper had been sketchy. An accident? Bedtime stories? Sophie flashed suddenly on her grandfather's overprotectiveness, how he never liked to leave her alone when she was young. Even when Sophie was grown and away at university, she had the sense her grandfather was watching over. She wondered if there had been Priory members in the shadows throughout her entire life, looking after her. "You suspected he was being manipulated," Langdon said, glaring with disbelief at Teabing. "So you murdered him?"
"I did not pull the trigger," Teabing said. "Sonier was dead years ago, when the church stole his family from him. He was compromised. Now he is free of that pain, released from the shame caused by his inability to carry out his sacred duty. Consider the alternative. Something had to be done. Shall the world be ignorant forever? Shall the church be allowed to cement its lies into our history books for all eternity? Shall the church be permitted to influence indefinitely with murder and extortion? No, something needed to be done. And now we are poised to carry out Sonier's legacy and right a terrible wrong." He paused. "The three of us. Together."
Sophie felt only incredulity.
"How could you possibly believe that we would help you?"
"Because, my dear, you are the reason the Priory failed to release the documents. Your grandfather's love for you prevented him from challenging the church. His fear of reprisal against his only remaining family crippled him. He never had a chance to explain the truth because you rejected him, tying his hands further, making him wait longer. Now you owe the world the truth. You owe it to the memory of your grandfather."
Robert Langdon had given up trying to get his bearings. Despite the torrent of questions running through his mind, he knew only one thing mattered now: getting Sophie out of here alive. All the guilt Langdon had mistakenly felt earlier for involving Teabing had now been transferred to Sophie.
"I took her to Chateau Villette. I am responsible."
Langdon could not fathom that Lee Teabing would be capable of killing them in cold blood here in the chapter house. And yet Teabing certainly had been involved in killing others during his misguided quest. Langdon had the uneasy feeling that gunshots in this secluded, thick-walled chamber would go unheard, especially in this rain.
"And Lee just admitted his guilt to us."
Langdon glanced at Sophie, who looked shaken.
"The church murdered Sophie's family to silence the Priory?"
Langdon knew the modern church did not murder people. There had to be some other explanation.
"Let Sophie leave," Langdon declared, staring at Lee. "You and I should discuss this alone."
Teabing gave an unnatural laugh.
"I'm afraid that is one show of faith I cannot afford. I can, however, offer you this."
He propped himself fully on his crutches, gracelessly keeping the gun aimed at Sophie, and removed the keystone from his pocket. He swayed a bit as he held it out for Langdon.
"A token of trust, Robert."
Robert felt wary and didn't move.
"Lee is giving the keystone back to us?"
"Take it," Teabing said, thrusting it awkwardly toward Langdon.
Langdon could imagine only one reason Teabing would give it back.
"You opened it already. You removed the map."
Teabing laughed, shaking his head.
"Robert, if I had solved the keystone, I would have disappeared to find the Grail myself and kept you uninvolved. No, I do not know the answer, and I can admit that freely. A true knight learns humility in the face of the Grail. He learns to obey the signs placed before him. When I saw you enter the Abbey, I understood. You were here for a reason. To help. I am not looking for singular glory here. I serve a far greater master than my own pride. The truth. Mankind deserves to know that truth. The Grail found us all, and now she is begging to be revealed. We must work together."
Despite Teabing's pleas for cooperation and trust, his gun remained trained on Sophie as Langdon stepped forward and accepted the cold marble cylinder. The vinegar inside gurgled as Langdon grasped it and stepped backwards. The dials were still in random order, and the cryptex remained locked. Langdon eyed Teabing. "How do you know I won't smash it right now?" Teabing's laugh was an eerie chortle.
"I should have realized your threat to break it in Temple Church was an empty one. Robert Langdon would never break the keystone. You are an historian, Robert. You are holding the key to 2,000 years of history, the lost key to the Sangreal. You can feel the souls of all the knights burned at the stake to protect her secret. Would you have them die in vain? No. You will vindicate them. You will join the ranks of the great men you admire, Da Vinci, Botticelli, Newton, each of whom would have been honored to be in your shoes right now. The contents of the keystone is crying out to us, longing to be set free. The time has come. Destiny has led us to this moment."
"I cannot help you, Lee. I have no idea how to open this. I only saw Newton's tomb for a moment, and even if I knew the password..." Langdon paused, realizing he had said too much.
"You would not tell me?" Teabing sighed. "I am disappointed and surprised, Robert, that you do not appreciate the extent to which you are in my debt. My task would have been far simpler had Remy and I eliminated you both when you walked into Chateau Villette. Instead, I risked everything to take the nobler course."
"This is noble?" Langdon demanded, eyeing the gun.
"Sonnier's fault," Teabing said. "He and his seneschal lied to Silas. Otherwise, I would have obtained the keystone without complication. How was I to imagine the Grand Master would go to such ends to deceive me and bequeath the keystone to an estranged granddaughter?"
Teabing looked at Sophie with disdain.
"Someone so unqualified to hold this knowledge that she required a symbologist babysitter."
Teabing glanced back at Langdon.
"Fortunately, Robert, your involvement turned out to be my saving grace. Rather than the keystone remaining locked in the depository bank forever, you extracted it and walked into my home."
"Where else would I run?" Langdon thought. "The community of Grail historians is small, and Teabing and I have a history together."
Teabing now looked smug. "When I learned Sonia had left you a dying message, I had a pretty good idea you were holding valuable priory information. Whether it was the keystone itself or information on where to find it, I was not sure. But with the police on your heels, I had a sneaking suspicion you might arrive on my doorstep."
Langdon glared. "And if we had not?"
"I was formulating a plan to extend you a helping hand. One way or another, the keystone was coming to Chateau Villette. The fact that you delivered it into my waiting hands only serves as proof that my cause is just."
"What?" Langdon was appalled.
"Silas was supposed to break in and steal the keystone from you in Chateau Villette, thus removing you from the equation without hurting you, and exonerating me from any suspicion of complicity. However, when I saw the intricacy of Sonia's codes, I decided to include you both in my quest a little bit longer. Certainly I could have had Silas steal the keystone later, once I knew enough to carry on alone."
"Temple Church," Sophie said, her tone awash with betrayal.
"Light begins to dawn," Teabing thought. He had known all along that Temple Church had no knights buried there, and yet its apparent relevance to the poem had proven a convenient decoy location at which to take control of the keystone. The mock kidnapping of Teabing and the keystone had gone smoothly until Langdon's impromptu threat to smash it on the stone floor rather than turn it over. Then Remy had panicked and foolishly revealed himself. "The one person who could incriminate me had shown his face." Silas had dragged Teabing out of the church, unaware of Teabing's true identity. Remy took over, loosely tying him in the back of the limousine. The ropes and tape were for show, a deception for Silas's benefit. Once the soundproof divider went up, Teabing untied the loose bonds and was able to phone Silas in the front seat. Using the phony French accent he had been using all along, he sent Silas to Opus Dei. Teabing had later phoned in an anonymous tip to the police. One loose end tied up. The other loose end was harder. Remy. Teabing struggled deeply with the decision, but in the end, Remy had proven himself a liability.
Every Grail quest requires sacrifice. The cleanest solution had been staring Teabing in the face from the limousine's wet bar, a flask, some cognac, and a can of peanuts. The powder at the bottom of the can was all it would take. When Remy parked the limo on Horse Guard's Way, Teabing climbed out of the back, walked to the side passenger door, and then climbed into the front next to Remy. Minutes later, Teabing got out of the car, climbed into the rear again, cleaned up the evidence, and finally emerged to carry out the final phase of his mission. Westminster Abbey had been a short walk, and although Teabing's leg braces had set off the metal detector, the rent-a-cops never knew what to do. Do we ask him to remove his braces and crawl through? Do we frisk his deformed body? Teabing presented the flustered guards a far easier solution, an embossed card identifying him as Knight of the Realm. The poor fellows practically tripped over one another, ushering him in. Now, eyeing the bewildered Langdon and Nouveau, Teabing resisted the urge to reveal how he had brilliantly implicated Opus Dei in the plot that would soon bring about the demise of the entire church. That would have to wait. Right now, there was work to do. Mes amis, Teabing declared in flawless French, vous ne trouvez pas le Saint Graal. C'est le Saint Graal qui vous trouve. He smiled. Our path together could not be more clear. The Grail has found us. Silence. He spoke to them in a whisper now. Listen. Can you hear it? The Grail is speaking to us across the centuries. She is begging to be saved from the Priory's folly. I implore you both to recognize this opportunity. There could not possibly be three more capable people assembled at this moment to break the final code and open the cryptex. Teabing paused, his eyes alight. We need to swear an oath together, a pledge of faith to one another, a knight's allegiance to uncover the truth and make it known. Sophie stared deep into Teabing's eyes and spoke in a steely tone. I will never swear an oath with my grandfather's murderer, except an oath that I will see you go to jail. Teabing's heart turned grave, then resolute. I am sorry you feel that way, mademoiselle. He turned and aimed the gun at Langdon. And you, Robert, are you with me or against me? Chapter 100. Bishop Manuel Aringarosa's body had endured many kinds of pain, and yet the searing heat of the bullet wound in his chest felt profoundly foreign to him. Deep and grave, not a wound of the flesh, but closer to the soul. He opened his eyes, trying to see, but the rain on his face blurred his vision. Where am I? He could feel powerful arms holding him, carrying his limp body like a rag doll, his black cassock flapping. Lifting a weary arm, he mopped his eyes and saw the man holding him was Silas. The great albino was struggling down a misty sidewalk, shouting for a hospital, his voice a heart-rending wail of agony. His red eyes were focused dead ahead, tears streaming down his pale, blood-spattered face.
My son, Aringarosa whispered. You're hurt.
Silas glanced down, his visage contorted in anguish.
I am so very sorry, father.
He seemed almost too pained to speak.
No, Silas, Aringarosa replied. It is I who am sorry. This is my fault. The teacher promised me there would be no killing, and I told you to obey him fully. I was too eager, too fearful. You and I were deceived. The teacher was never going to deliver us the Holy Grail.
Cradled in the arms of the man he had taken in all those years ago, Bishop Aringarosa felt himself reel back in time. To Spain, to his modest beginnings, building a small Catholic church in Oviedo with Silas, and later to New York City, where he had proclaimed the glory of God with the towering Opus Dei Center on Lexington Avenue. 5 months ago, Aringarosa had received devastating news. His life's work was in jeopardy. He recalled with vivid detail the meeting inside Castel Gandolfo that had changed his life, the news that had set this entire calamity in motion. Aringarosa had entered Gandolfo's astronomy library with his head held high, fully expecting to be lauded by throngs of welcoming hands, all eager to clasp him on the back for his superior work representing Catholicism in America. But only three people were present. The Vatican Secretariat, obese, dour, two high-ranking Italian cardinals, sanctimonious, smug.
Secretariat? Aringarosa said, puzzled.
The rotund overseer of legal affairs shook Aringarosa's hand and motioned him to the chair opposite him.
Please, make yourself comfortable.
Aringarosa sat, sensing something was wrong.
I am not skilled in small talk, Bishop, the Secretariat said, so let me be direct about the reason for your visit.
Please speak openly. Aringarosa glanced at the two cardinals, who seemed to be measuring him with self-righteous anticipation.
As you are well aware, the Secretariat said, His Holiness and others in Rome have been concerned lately with the political fallout from Opus Dei's conservative, controversial practices.
Aringarosa felt himself bristle instantly. He already had been through this on numerous occasions with the new pontiff, who, to Aringarosa's great dismay, had turned out to be a distressingly fervent voice for liberal change in the church.
I want to assure you, the Secretariat added quickly, that His Holiness does not seek to change anything about the way you run your ministry.
I should hope not.
Then why am I here? The enormous man sighed.
Bishop, I'm not sure how to say this delicately, so I will state it directly. 2 days ago, the Secretariat Council voted unanimously to revoke the Vatican's sanction of Opus Dei.
Aringarosa was certain he had heard incorrectly.
I beg your pardon?
Plainly stated, 6 months from today, Opus Dei will no longer be considered a prelature of the Vatican. You will be a church unto yourself. The Holy See will be disassociating itself from you. His Holiness agrees, and we are already drawing up the legal papers.
But that's impossible.
On the contrary, it is quite possible and necessary. His Holiness has become uneasy with your aggressive recruiting policies and your insistence on corporal mortification. He paused. Also your policies regarding women. Quite frankly, Opus Dei has become a liability and an embarrassment.
Bishop Aringarosa was stupefied.
An embarrassment?
Certainly you cannot be surprised it has come to this.
Opus Dei is the only Catholic organization whose numbers are growing.
True. A troubling issue for us all.
Aringarosa shot to his feet.
Ask His Holiness if Opus Dei was an embarrassment in the 1982 when we single-handedly bailed out the Vatican Bank.
The Vatican will always be grateful for that, the Secretariat said, his tone appeasing. And yet there are those who still believe your financial munificence in 1982 is the only reason Pope John Paul II granted you prelature status in the first place.
That is not true.
Whatever the case, in good faith, we are drawing up severance terms that will include a reimbursement of those monies. It will be paid in 5 installments.
You're buying me off?
Aringarosa demanded.
Paying me to go quietly? When Opus Dei is the only remaining voice of reason?
One of the cardinals glanced up.
I'm sorry. Did you say reason?
Aringarosa leaned across the table, sharpening his tone to a point.
Do you really wonder why Catholics are leaving the church? Look around you, Cardinal. People have lost respect. The rigors of faith are gone. The doctrine has become a buffet line. Abstinence, confession, communion, baptism, mass, take your pick, choose whatever combination pleases you and ignore the rest. What kind of spiritual guidance is the church offering?
3rd century laws, the second cardinal said, cannot be applied to the modern followers of Christ. The rules are not workable in today's society.
Well, they seem to be working for Opus Dei.
Bishop Aringarosa, the Secretariat said, his voice conclusive, out of respect for your organization's relationship with the previous pope, His Holiness will be giving Opus Dei 6 months to voluntarily break away from the Vatican. I suggest you cite your differences of opinion with the Holy See and establish yourself as your own Christian organization.
I refuse, Aringarosa declared, and I'll tell him that in person.
I'm afraid His Holiness no longer cares to meet with you.
Aringarosa stood up.
He would not dare abolish a personal prelature established by a previous pope.
I'm sorry. The secretariat's eyes did not flinch. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away.
Aringarosa had staggered from that meeting in bewilderment and panic. Returning to New York, he stared out at the skyline in disillusionment for days, overwhelmed with sadness for the future of Christianity. It was several weeks later that he received the phone call that changed all that. The caller sounded French, and identified himself as the Teacher, a title common in the prelature. He said he knew of the Vatican's plans to pull support from Opus Dei.
How could he know that? Aringarosa wondered.
Only a handful of Vatican power brokers knew of Opus Dei's impending annulment.
I have ears everywhere, Bishop, the Teacher whispered, and with these ears I have gained certain knowledge. With your help, I can uncover the hiding place of a sacred relic that will bring you enormous power. Enough power to make the Vatican bow before you. Enough power to save the faith. He paused. Not just for Opus Dei, but for all of us.
The Lord taketh away, and the Lord giveth. Aringarosa felt a glorious ray of hope.
Tell me your plan.
Bishop Aringarosa was unconscious when the doors of the Parkside Hospital near Kensington Green hissed open. Silas lurched into the lobby delirious with exhaustion. Dropping to his knees on the tiled floor, he cried out for help. Everyone in the lobby gaped in wonderment at the half-naked albino offering forth a bleeding clergyman. The doctor who helped Silas heave the delirious bishop onto a gurney looked gloomy as he felt Aringarosa's pulse.
He's lost a lot of blood. I am not hopeful.
Aringarosa's eyes flickered, and he returned for a moment, his gaze locating Silas.
My child.
Silas's soul thundered with remorse and rage.
Father, if it takes my lifetime, I will find the one who deceived us, and I will kill him.
Aringarosa shook his head, looking sad as they prepared to wheel him away.
Silas, if you have learned nothing from me, please, learn this.
He took Silas's hand and gave it a firm squeeze.
Forgiveness is God's greatest gift. But Father!
Aringarosa closed his eyes.
Silas, you must pray.
Chapter 101. Robert Langdon stood beneath the lofty cupola of the deserted chapter house and stared into the barrel of Lee Teabing's gun.
Et tu, Robert, are you with me or against me?
The royal historian's words echoed in the silence of Langdon's mind. There was no viable response, Langdon knew. Answer yes, and he would be selling out Sophie. Answer no, and Teabing would have no choice but to kill them both. Langdon's years in the classroom had not imbued him with any skills relevant to handling confrontations at gunpoint, but the classroom had taught him something about answering paradoxical questions. When a question has no correct answer, there is only one honest response. The gray area between yes and no. Silence. Staring at the cryptex in his hands, Langdon chose simply to walk away. Without ever lifting his eyes, he stepped backwards, out into the room's vast empty spaces. Neutral ground. He hoped his focus on the cryptex signaled Teabing that collaboration might be an option, and that his silence signaled Sophie he had not abandoned her. All the while buying time to think. The act of thinking, Langdon suspected, was exactly what Teabing wanted him to do. That's why he handed me the cryptex, so I could feel the weight of my decision. The British historian hoped the touch of the Grandmaster's cryptex would make Langdon fully grasp the magnitude of its contents, coaxing his academic curiosity to overwhelm all else, forcing him to realize that failure to unlock the keystone would mean the loss of history itself. With Sophie at gunpoint across the room, Langdon feared that discovering the cryptex's elusive password would be his only remaining hope of bartering her release.
If I can free the map, Teabing will negotiate.
Forcing his mind to this critical task, Langdon moved slowly toward the far windows, allowing his mind to fill with images of Newton's tomb. You seek the orb that ought be on his tomb. It speaks of rosy flesh and seeded womb. Turning his back to the others, he walked toward the towering windows, searching for any inspiration in their stained glass mosaics. There was none.
Place yourself in Sonia's mind, he urged,
gazing outward now into College Garden.
What would he believe is the orb that ought be on Newton's tomb?
Images of stars, comets, and planets twinkled in the falling rain, but Langdon ignored them. Sonier was not a man of science. He was a man of humanity, of art, of history.
The sacred feminine, the chalice, the rose, the banished Mary Magdalene, the decline of the goddess, the Holy Grail.
Legend had always portrayed the Grail as a cruel mistress, dancing in the shadows just out of sight, whispering in your ear, luring you one more step, and then evaporating into the mist. Gazing out at the rustling trees of College Garden, Langdon sensed her playful presence. The signs were everywhere, like a taunting silhouette emerging from the fog. The branches of Britain's oldest apple tree burgeoned with five-petaled blossoms, all glistening like Venus. The goddess was in the garden now. She was dancing in the rain, singing songs of the ages, peeking out from behind the bud-filled branches, as if to remind Langdon that the fruit of knowledge was growing, just beyond his reach. Across the room, Sir Lee Teabing watched with confidence as Langdon gazed out the window as if under a spell.
Exactly as I hoped, Teabing thought. He will come around.
For some time now, Teabing had suspected Langdon might hold the key to the Grail. It was no coincidence that Teabing launched his plan into action on the same night Langdon was scheduled to meet Jacques Sonnier. Listening in on the curator, Teabing was certain the man's eagerness to meet privately with Langdon could mean only one thing.
Langdon's mysterious manuscript has touched a nerve with the Priory. Langdon has stumbled onto a truth, and Sonnier fears its release.
Teabing felt certain the Grand Master was summoning Langdon to silence him.
The truth has been silenced long enough.
Teabing knew he had to act quickly. Silas's attack would accomplish two goals. It would prevent Sonnier from persuading Langdon to keep quiet, and it would ensure that once the keystone was in Teabing's hands, Langdon would be in Paris for recruitment, should Teabing need him. As it turned out, Langdon had come to Chateau Villette instead.
Yet another sign the Grail longs to be found.
Arranging the fatal meeting between Sonnier and Silas had been almost too easy.
I had inside information about Sonnier's deepest fears.
Yesterday afternoon, Silas had phoned the curator and posed as a distraught priest.
Monsieur Sonnier, forgive me, I must speak to you at once. I should never breach the sanctity of confessional, but in this case I feel I must. I just took confession from a man who claimed to have murdered members of your family.
Sonnier's response was startled but wary.
My family died in an accident. The police report was conclusive.
Yes, a car accident, Silas said, baiting the hook. The man I spoke to said he forced their car off the road into a river.
Sonnier fell silent.
Monsieur Sonnier, I would never have phoned you directly except this man made a comment which makes me now fear for your safety. He paused. The man also mentioned your granddaughter, Sophie.
The mention of Sophie's name had been the catalyst. The curator leapt into action. He ordered Silas to come see him immediately in the safest location Sonnier knew, his Louvre office. Then he phoned Sophie to warn her she might be in danger. Drinks with Robert Langdon were instantly abandoned. Now, with Langdon separated from Sophie on the far side of the room, Teabing sensed he had successfully alienated the two companions from one another. Sophie Neveu remained defiant, but Langdon clearly saw the larger picture. He was trying to figure out the password.
He understands the importance of finding the Grail and releasing her from bondage.
He won't open it for you, Sophie said coldly, even if he can.
Teabing was glancing at Langdon as he held the gun on Sophie. He was fairly certain now he was going to have to use it. Although the idea troubled him, he knew he would not hesitate if it came to that.
I have given her every opportunity to do the right thing. The Grail is bigger than any one of us.
At that moment, Langdon turned from the window.
The tomb,
he said suddenly, facing them, with a faint glimmer of hope in his eyes.
I know where to look on Newton's tomb. Yes, I think I can find the password.
Teabing's heart soared.
Where, Robert? Tell me!
Sophie sounded horrified.
Robert, no! You're not going to help him, are you?
Langdon approached with a resolute stride, holding the sealed cryptex before him. No, he said, his eyes hardening as he turned to Lee. Not until he lets you go. Teabing's optimism darkened.
We're so close, Robert! Don't you dare start playing games with me!
No games, Langdon said. Let her go. Then I'll take you to Newton's tomb. We'll open the cryptex together.
I'm not going anywhere, Sophie declared, her green eyes narrowing with rage. That cryptex was given to me by my grandfather. It is not yours to open.
Langdon wheeled, looking fearful.
Sophie, please.
You're in danger. I'm trying to help you.
How? By unveiling the secret my grandfather died trying to protect? He trusted you, Robert. I trusted you.
Langdon's blue eyes showed panic now, and Teabing could not help but smile to see the two of them working against one another. Langdon's attempts to be gallant were more pathetic than anything.
On the verge of unveiling one of history's greatest secrets, and he troubles himself with a woman who has proven herself unworthy of the quest. Sophie, Langdon pleaded, please, you must leave.
She shook her head.
Not unless you either hand me the cryptex or smash it on the floor.
What? Langdon gasped.
Robert, my grandfather would prefer his secret lost forever than see it in the hands of his murderer.
How would you know? Teabing snapped, incensed. You ignored him for the last 10 years. Do you even know him? Do you really think last night was the night he died? No, no, he died years ago. When the church took his family from him, and then his only granddaughter turned her back on him, refused to see him or even read his letters. Lee, Langdon snapped, that's enough. No, Robert, that's not enough. Miss Neveu, it was your stubbornness that held the Priory hostage for all these years. Your stubbornness that prevented your grandfather from making amends and explaining to you the situation he was in. You've stood in the way of the truth long enough, and I will not permit it another second. If you could open your eyes for just a moment, you would realize your grandfather is looking down on you right now and willing you to help us carry out the task he could not complete. Sophie's eyes looked as if they would well with tears, but they did not. She stared directly back at Teabing.
Shoot me if you have to. I'm not leaving my grandfather's legacy in your hands.
Very well. Teabing aimed the weapon.
No!
Langdon shouted, raising his arm and suspending the cryptex precariously over the hard stone floor. Lee, if you even think about it, I will drop this. Teabing laughed. That bluff worked on Remy, not on me. I know you better than that.
Do you, Lee?
Yes, I do. Your poker face needs work, my friend. It took me several seconds, but I can see now that you are lying. You have no idea where on Newton's tomb the answer lies. Truly, Robert, you know where on the tomb to look?
I do.
The falter in Langdon's eyes was fleeting, but Lee caught it. There was a lie there, a desperate, pathetic ploy to save Sophie. Teabing felt a profound disappointment in Robert Langdon.
I am a lone knight, surrounded by unworthy souls, and I will have to decipher the keystone on my own.
Langdon and Neveu were nothing but a threat to Teabing now, and to the Grail. As painful as the solution was going to be, he knew he could carry it out with a clean conscience.
The only challenge would be to persuade Langdon to set down the keystone so Teabing could safely end this charade. A show of faith, Teabing said, lowering the gun from Sophie. Set down the keystone, and we'll talk. Langdon knew his lie had failed. He could see the dark resolve in Teabing's face, and knew the moment was upon them. When I set this down, he will kill us both. Even without looking at Sophie, he could feel her heart beseeching him in silent desperation.
Robert, this man is not worthy of the Grail. Please do not place it in his hands, no matter what the cost.
Langdon had already made his decision several minutes ago, while standing alone at the window overlooking College Garden. Protect Sophie. Protect the Grail. Langdon had almost shouted out in desperation,
But I cannot see how.
The stark minutes of disillusionment had brought with them a clarity unlike any he had ever felt.
The truth is right before your eyes, Robert.
He knew not from where the epiphany came.
The Grail is not mocking you. She is calling out to a worthy soul.
Now, kneeling down like a subject several yards in front of Lee Teabing, Langdon lowered the cryptex to within inches of the stone floor.
Yes, Robert, Teabing whispered, aiming the gun at him. Set it down.
Langdon's eyes moved heavenward, up into the gaping void of the chapter house cupola. Crouching lower, Langdon lowered his gaze to Teabing's gun, aimed directly at him.
I'm sorry, Lee.
In one fluid motion, Langdon leapt up, swinging his arm skyward, launching the cryptex straight up toward the dome above. Lee Teabing did not feel his finger pull the trigger, but the Medusa discharged with a thundering crash. Langdon's crouched form was now vertical, almost airborne, and the bullet exploded in the floor near Langdon's feet. Half of Teabing's brain attempted to adjust his aim and fire again in rage, but the more powerful half dragged his eyes upward into the cupola.
The keystone!
Time seemed to freeze, morphing into a slow-motion dream as Teabing's entire world became the airborne keystone. He watched it rise to the apex of its climb, hovering for a moment in the void, and then tumbling downward, end over end, back toward the stone floor. All of Teabing's hopes and dreams were plummeting toward Earth.
It cannot strike the floor. I can reach it.
Teabing's body reacted on instinct. He released the gun and heaved himself forward, dropping his crutches as he reached out with his soft, manicured hands. Stretching his arms and fingers, he snatched the keystone from midair. Teabing sailed forward, the keystone victoriously clutched in his hand, but he was falling too fast. With nothing to break his fall, his outstretched arms hit first, and the cryptex collided hard with the floor. There was a sickening crunch of glass within. For a full second, Teabing did not breathe. Lying there, outstretched on the cold floor, staring up the length of his outstretched arms at the marble cylinder in his bare palms, he implored the glass vial inside to hold. The acrid tang of vinegar cut the air, and Teabing felt the cool liquid flowing out through the dials onto his palm.
Wild panic gripped him. No!
The vinegar was streaming now, and Teabing pictured the parchment dissolving within.
Robert, you fool, the secret is lost.
Teabing felt himself sobbing uncontrollably.
The Grail is gone. Everything destroyed.
Shuddering in disbelief over Langdon's actions, Teabing tried to force the cylinder apart, longing to catch a fleeting glimpse of history before it dissolved forever. To his shock, as he pulled the ends of the keystone, the cylinder separated. He gasped and peered inside. It was empty except for shards of wet glass. No dissolving parchment. Teabing rolled over and looked up at Langdon. Sophie stood beside him, aiming the gun down at Teabing. Bewildered, Teabing looked back at the keystone and saw it. The dials were no longer at random. They spelled a five-letter word. Apple. The orb from which Eve partook, Langdon said coolly, incurring the holy wrath of God, original sin, the symbol of the fall of the sacred feminine. Teabing felt the truth come crashing down on him in excruciating austerity. The orb that ought to be on Newton's tomb could be none other than the rosy apple that fell from heaven, struck Newton on the head, and inspired his life's work.
His labor's fruit, the rosy flesh with a seeded womb.
Robert,
Teabing stammered, overwhelmed.
You opened it. Where is the map?
Without blinking, Langdon reached into the breast pocket of his tweed coat and carefully extracted a delicate rolled parchment. Only a few yards from where Teabing lay, Langdon unrolled the scroll and looked at it. After a long moment, a knowing smile crossed Langdon's face.
He knows!
Teabing's heart craved that knowledge. His life's dream was right in front of him.
Tell me, Teabing demanded. Please, oh God, please, it's not too late.
As the sound of heavy footsteps thundered down the hall toward Chapter House, Langdon quietly rolled the parchment and slipped it back in his pocket.
No!
Teabing cried out, trying in vain to stand. When the doors burst open, Bezu Fash entered like a bull into a ring, his feral eyes scanning, finding his target, Lee Teabing, helpless on the floor. Exhaling in relief, Fash holstered his Mannerin's sidearm and turned to Sophie.
As your neveu, I am relieved you and Mr. Langdon are safe. You should have come in when I asked.
The British police entered on Fash's heels, seizing the anguished prisoner and placing him in handcuffs.
It's in his pocket,
Teabing was screaming like a madman.
The map to the Holy Grail!
As they hoisted Teabing and carried him out, Teabing threw back his head and howled,
Robert, tell me where it is hidden!
As Teabing passed, Langdon looked him in the eye.
Only the worthy find the Grail, Lee. You taught me that.
Chapter 102. The mist had settled low on Kensington Green as Silas limped into a quiet hollow out of sight. Kneeling on the wet grass, he could feel a warm stream of blood flowing from the bullet wound below his ribs. Still, he stared straight ahead. The fog made it look like heaven here. Raising his bloody hands to pray, he watched the raindrops caress his fingers, turning them white again. As the droplets fell harder across his back and shoulders, he could feel his body disappearing bit by bit into the mist.
I am a ghost.
A breeze rustled past him, carrying the damp, earthy scent of new life. With every living cell in his broken body, Silas prayed. He prayed for forgiveness. He prayed for mercy. And above all, he prayed for his mentor, Bishop Arengarosa, that the Lord would not take him before his time.
He has so much work left to do.
The fog was swirling around him now, and Silas felt so light that he was sure the wisps would carry him away. Closing his eyes, he said a final prayer. From somewhere in the mist, the voice of Manuel Arengarosa whispered to him,
Our Lord is a good and merciful God.
Silas's pain at last began to fade, and he knew the bishop was right. Chapter 103. It was late afternoon when the London sun broke through and the city began to dry. Bezu Fash felt weary as he emerged from the interrogation room and hailed a cab. Sir Teabing had vociferously proclaimed his innocence, and yet from his incoherent rantings about the Holy Grail, secret documents, and mysterious brotherhoods, Fash suspected the wily historian was setting the stage for his lawyers to plead an insanity defense.
Sure, Fash thought. Insane.
Teabing had displayed ingenious precision in formulating a plan that protected his innocence at every turn. His listening post was in the one place a man with polio could not reach. He exploited both the Vatican and Opus Dei, two groups that turned out to be completely innocent. His dirty work had been carried out unknowingly by a fanatical monk and a desperate bishop. And the lone man privy to Teabing's true identity was conveniently dead of an allergic reaction.
Hardly the handiwork of someone lacking mental faculties, Fash thought.
The information coming from Calais out of Chateau Villette suggested that Teabing's cunning ran so deep that Fash himself might even learn from it. To successfully hide bugs in some of Paris's most powerful offices, the British historian had turned to the Greeks.
Trojan horses.
Some of Teabing's intended targets received lavish gifts of artwork, others unwittingly bid at auctions in which Teabing had placed specific lots. In Saunière's case, the curator had received a dinner invitation to Chateau Villette to discuss the possibility of Teabing funding a new Da Vinci wing at the Louvre. Saunière's invitation had contained an innocuous postscript expressing fascination with a robotic knight that Saunière was rumored to have built. "Bring him to dinner," Teabing had suggested. Saunière apparently had done just that, and left the knight unattended long enough for Rémy Legaludec to make one inconspicuous addition. Now, sitting in the back of the cab, Fash closed his eyes.
"One more thing to attend to before I return to Paris."
The Parkside Hospital recovery room was sunny.
"You've impressed us all," the nurse said, smiling down at him. "Nothing short of miraculous."
Bishop Aringarosa gave a weak smile.
"I have always been blessed."
The nurse finished puttering, leaving the bishop alone. The sunlight felt welcome and warm on his face. Last night had been the darkest night of his life. Despondently, he thought of Silas, whose body had been found in the park.
"Please forgive me, my son."
Aringarosa had longed for Silas to be part of his glorious plan. Last night, however, Aringarosa had received a call from Bezu Fash, questioning the bishop about his apparent connection to a nun who had been murdered in Saint-Sulpice. Aringarosa realized the evening had taken a horrifying turn. News of the four additional murders transformed his horror to anguish.
"Silas, what have you done?"
Unable to reach the teacher, the bishop knew he had been cut loose.
Used.
The only way to stop the horrific chain of events he had helped put in motion was to confess everything to Fash, and from that moment on, Aringarosa and Fash had been racing to catch up with Silas before the teacher persuaded him to kill again. Feeling bone-weary, Aringarosa closed his eyes and listened to the television coverage of the arrest of a prominent British knight, Sir Lee Teabing.
"The teacher laid bare for all to see."
Teabing had caught wind of the Vatican's plans to excommunicate Opus Dei. He had chosen Aringarosa as the perfect pawn in his plan.
"After all, who more likely to leap blindly after the Holy Grail than a man like myself with everything to lose? The Grail would have brought enormous power to anyone who possessed it."
Sir Teabing had protected his identity shrewdly, feigning a French accent and a pious heart, and demanding as payment the one thing he did not need—money. Aringarosa had been far too eager to be suspicious. The price tag of 20 million euro was paltry when compared with the prize of obtaining the Grail, and with the Vatican's separation payment to Opus Dei, the finances had worked nicely.
"The blind see what they want to see."
Teabing's ultimate insult, of course, had been to demand payment in Vatican bonds, such that if anything went wrong, the investigation would lead to Rome.
"I am glad to see you are well, Bishop."
Aringarosa recognized the gruff voice in the doorway. But the face was unexpected. Stern, powerful features, slicked back hair, and a broad neck that strained against his uniform.
"Captain Fash?" Aringarosa said.
The compassion and concern the captain had shown for Aringarosa's plight last night had conjured images of a far gentler physique. The captain approached the bed and hoisted a familiar heavy black briefcase onto a chair.
"I believe this belongs to you."
Aringarosa looked at the briefcase filled with bonds and immediately looked away, feeling only shame.
"Yes. Thank you."
He paused while working his fingers across the seam of his bedsheet, then continued.
"Captain,
I have been giving this deep thought, and I need to ask a favor of you.
Of course.
The families of those in Paris who Silas... He paused, swallowing the emotion. I realize no sum could possibly serve as sufficient restitution, and yet, if you could be kind enough to divide the contents of this briefcase among them, the families of the deceased... Fash's dark eyes studied him a long moment.
A virtuous gesture, Bishop. I will see to it your wishes are carried out.
A heavy silence fell between them. On the television, a lean French police officer was giving a press conference in front of a sprawling mansion. Fash saw who it was and turned his attention to the screen. Lieutenant Collet, a BBC reporter said, her voice accusing, last night your captain publicly charged two innocent people with murder. Will Robert Langdon and Sophie Neveu be seeking accountability from your department? Will this cost Captain Fash his job? Lieutenant Collet's smile was tired but calm. It is my experience that Captain Bezu Fash seldom makes mistakes. I have not yet spoken to him on this matter, but knowing how he operates, I suspect his public manhunt for Eugène Neveu and Mr. Langdon was part of a ruse to lure out the real killer. The reporters exchanged surprised looks. Whether or not Monsieur Langdon and Eugène Neveu were willing participants in the sting, I do not know. Captain Fash tends to keep his more creative methods to himself. All I can confirm at this point is that the captain has successfully arrested the man responsible, and that Mr. Langdon and Eugène Neveu are both innocent and safe. Fash had a faint smile on his lips as he turned back to Aringarosa.
A good man, that Collet. I believe he has been a lieutenant long enough.
Fash ran his hand back over his forehead, slicking back his hair, as he gazed down at Aringarosa.
Bishop, I must return to Paris. But before I go, there is one unfortunate final matter. Your impromptu flight to London. You bribed a pilot to change course. In doing so, you broke a number of international laws.
Aringarosa slumped.
I was desperate. Yes, as was the pilot when my men interrogated him.
Fash reached in his pocket and produced a purple amethyst ring with a familiar hand-tooled mitre crozier applique. Aringarosa felt tears welling as he slipped the ring back on his finger.
You have been so kind.
He held out his hand and clasped Fash's.
Thank you.
Fash waved off the gesture, walking to the window and gazing out at the city, his thoughts obviously far away. When he turned, there was an uncertainty about him.
Bishop, where do you go from here?
Aringarosa had been asked the exact same question as he left Castel Gandolfo the night before.
I suspect my path is as uncertain as yours. Yes, Fash paused. I suspect I will be retiring early.
Aringarosa smiled.
A little faith can do wonders, Captain. A little faith.
Chapter 104. Rosslyn Chapel, often called the Cathedral of Codes, stands on the site of an ancient Mithraic temple in Scotland. Built by the Knights Templar in 1446, the chapel is engraved with a mind-boggling array of symbols from the Jewish, Christian, Egyptian, Masonic, and pagan traditions. The chapel's geographic coordinates fall precisely on the north-south meridian that runs through Glastonbury. This longitudinal rose line is the traditional marker of King Arthur's Isle of Avalon and is considered the central pillar of Britain's sacred geometry. It is from this hallowed rose line that Rosslyn, originally spelled R-O-S-L-I-N, takes its name. Rosslyn's rugged spires were casting long evening shadows as Robert Langdon and Sophie Neveu pulled their rental car into the grassy parking area at the foot of the bluff on which the building rose. Their short flight from London to Edinburgh had been restful, although neither of them had slept for the uncertainty of what lay ahead. Gazing up at the stark edifice framed against a cloud-swept sky, Langdon felt like Alice falling headlong through the looking glass.
This must be a dream.
and yet he knew the text on Sonier's final parchment could not have been more specific. The Holy Grail, 'neath ancient Roslin waits. Langdon had fantasized that Sonier's Grail map would be a diagram, a drawing with an X marks the spot. And yet the Priory's final secret had been unveiled in the same way Sonier had spoken to them from the beginning. Simple verse. 4 explicit lines that pointed without a doubt to this very spot. In addition to identifying Roslin by name, the verse made clear reference to several of the chapel's renowned architectural features. Despite the clarity of Sonier's final revelation, Langdon had been left feeling more off balance than enlightened. To him, Roslin Chapel seemed far too obvious a location. For centuries, this stone chapel had echoed with whispers of the Holy Grail's presence. The whispers had turned to shouts in recent decades when ultrasound ground scans revealed the presence of an astonishing structure beneath the chapel, a massive subterranean chamber. Not only did this deep vault dwarf the chapel atop it, but it appeared to have no entrance or exit. Archaeologists petitioned to begin blasting through the bedrock to reach the mysterious chamber. But the Roslin Trust expressly forbid any excavation of the sacred site. Of course, this only fueled the fires of speculation. What was the Roslin Trust trying to hide? Roslin had now become a pilgrimage site for mystery seekers. Some claimed they were drawn here by the powerful magnetic force that emanated inexplicably from these coordinates. Some claimed they came to search the hillside for a hidden entrance to the vault. But most admitted they had come simply to wander the grounds and absorb the lore of the Holy Grail. Although Langdon had never been to Roslin before now, he always chuckled when he heard the chapel mentioned as the current home of the Holy Grail. It certainly seemed as if Roslin may have once been home to the Grail, long ago, but no longer. Far too much attention had been drawn to Roslin in past decades, and sooner or later someone would find a way to break into the vault. True Grail academics agreed that Roslin was a decoy, one of the devious dead ends the Priory crafted so convincingly. Tonight, however, with the Priory's keystone unlocking a verse that pointed directly to this spot, Langdon no longer felt so smug. A perplexing question had been running through his mind all day. Why would Sonier go to such effort to guide us to this obvious location? There seemed only one logical answer. There is something about Roslin we have yet to understand. Robert, Sophie was standing outside the car looking back at him. Are you coming? She was holding the rosewood box, which Captain Fash had returned to them. Inside, both cryptexes had been reassembled and nested as they had been found. The parchment verse was locked safely at its core, minus the shattered vial of vinegar. Making their way up the long gravel path, Langdon and Sophie passed the famous west wall of the chapel. Casual visitors assumed this oddly protruding wall was a section of the chapel that had not been finished. The truth, Langdon recalled, was far more intriguing. The west wall of Solomon's Temple. The Knights Templar had designed Roslin Chapel as an exact architectural blueprint of Solomon's Temple in Jerusalem, complete with a west wall, a narrow rectangular sanctuary, and a subterranean vault like the Holy of Holies, in which the original 9 knights had first unearthed their priceless treasure. Langdon had to admit, there existed an intriguing symmetry in the idea of the Templars building a modern Grail repository that echoed the Grail's original hiding place. Roslin Chapel's entrance was more modest than Langdon expected. The small wooden door had 2 iron hinges and a simple oak sign. Roslin. It was the ancient spelling, Langdon explained to Sophie, derived from the Roseline meridian on which the chapel sat, or, as Grail academics preferred to believe, from the line of Rose, the ancestral lineage of Mary Magdalene. The chapel would be closing soon, and as Langdon pulled open the door, a warm puff of air escaped, as if the ancient edifice were heaving a weary sigh at the end of a long day. Her entry arches burgeoned with carved cinquefoils. Roses, the womb of the goddess. Entering with Sophie, Langdon felt his eyes reaching across the famous sanctuary and taking it all in. Although he had read accounts of Roslin's arrestingly intricate stonework, seeing it in person was an overwhelming encounter. Symbology heaven, one of Langdon's colleagues had called it. More like hell, Langdon thought, staring into the sanctuary. Every surface in the chapel had been carved with symbols. Christian cruciforms, Jewish stars, Masonic seals, Templar crosses, cornucopias, pyramids, astrological signs, plants, vegetables, pentacles, and roses. The Knights Templar had been master stonemasons, erecting Templar churches all over Europe, but Rosslyn was considered their most sublime labor of love and veneration. The master masons had left no stone uncarved. Rosslyn Chapel was a shrine to all faiths, to all traditions, and above all, to nature and the goddess. The sanctuary was empty except for a handful of visitors, listening to a young man giving the day's last tour. He was leading them in a single file along a well-known route on the floor, an invisible pathway linking six key architectural points within the sanctuary. Generations of visitors had walked these straight lines, connecting the points, and their countless footsteps had engraved an enormous symbol on the floor. A six-pointed star, the seal of Solomon, Langdon thought. No coincidence there. The docent had seen Langdon and Sophie enter, and although it was closing time, offered a pleasant smile and motioned for them to feel free to look around. Langdon nodded his thanks and began to move deeper into the sanctuary. Sophie, however, stood riveted in the entryway, a puzzled look on her face. "What is it?" Langdon asked. Sophie stared out at the chapel.
"I think I've been here."
Langdon was surprised. "But you said you hadn't even heard of Rosslyn."
"I hadn't."
She scanned the sanctuary, looking uncertain.
"My grandfather must have brought me here when I was very young. I don't know, it feels familiar."
As her eyes scanned the room, she began nodding with more certainty.
"Yes."
She pointed to the front of the sanctuary.
"Those two pillars. I've seen them."
Langdon looked at the pair of intricately sculpted columns at the far end of the sanctuary. Their white lacework carvings seemed to smolder with a ruddy glow as the last of the day's sunlight streamed in through the west window. The pillars, positioned where the altar would be in a Christian church, were an oddly matched pair. The pillar on the left was carved with simple vertical lines, while the pillar on the right was embellished with an ornate flowering spiral. Sophie was already moving toward them. Langdon hurried after her, and as they reached the pillars, Sophie was nodding with incredulity.
"Yes, I'm positive I have seen these."
"I don't doubt you've seen them," Langdon said, "but it wasn't necessarily here." She turned.
"What do you mean?"
"These two pillars are the most duplicated architectural structures in history. Replicas exist all over the world."
"Replicas of Rosslyn?"
She looked skeptical. "No. Do you remember earlier that I mentioned Rosslyn itself is a replica of Solomon's temple? Those two pillars are exact copies of the two pillars that stood at the head of Solomon's temple." Langdon pointed to the pillar on the left. "That's called Boaz, or the Mason's pillar. The other is called Yachin, or the Apprentice pillar." He paused. "In fact, almost every Masonic temple in the world has two pillars like these." Langdon had already explained to her about the Templars' powerful historic ties to the modern Masonic secret societies, whose primary degrees, Apprentice Freemason, Fellowcraft Freemason, and Master Mason, harked back to early Templar days. Sophie's grandfather's final verse made direct reference to the Master Masons who adorned Rosslyn with their carved artistic offerings. It also noted Rosslyn's central ceiling, which was covered with carvings of stars and planets.
"I've never been in a Masonic temple," Sophie said, still eyeing the pillars. "I am almost positive I saw these here."
She turned back into the chapel, as if looking for something else to jog her memory. The rest of the visitors were now leaving, and the young docent made his way across the chapel to them with a pleasant smile. He was a handsome young man in his late 20s, with a Scottish brogue and strawberry blonde hair.
"I'm about to close up for the day. May I help you find anything?"
"How about the Holy Grail?" Langdon wanted to say.
"The code," Sophie blurted in sudden revelation. "There's a code here."
The docent looked pleased by her enthusiasm.
"Why, yes, there is, ma'am."
"It's on the ceiling," she said, turning to the right-hand wall. "Somewhere over there."
He smiled.
Not your first visit to Rosslyn, I see.
The code, Langdon thought. He had forgotten that little bit of lore. Among Rosslyn's numerous mysteries was a vaulted archway from which hundreds of stone blocks protruded, jutting down to form a bizarre, multifaceted surface. Each block was carved with a symbol, seemingly at random, creating a cipher of unfathomable proportion. Some people believed the code revealed the entrance to the vault beneath the chapel. Others believed it told the true Grail legend. Not that it mattered. Cryptographers had been trying for centuries to decipher its meaning. To this day, the Rosslyn Trust offered a generous reward to anyone who could unveil the secret meaning, but the code remained a mystery.
I'd be happy to show...
The docent's voice trailed off.
My first code, Sophie thought, moving alone in a trance toward the encoded archway.
Having handed the rosewood box to Langdon, she could feel herself momentarily forgetting all about the Holy Grail, the Priory of Sion, and all the mysteries of the past day. When she arrived beneath the encoded ceiling and saw the symbols above her, the memories came flooding back. She was recalling her first visit here, and strangely, the memories conjured an unexpected sadness. She was a little girl, a year or so after her family's death. Her grandfather had brought her to Scotland on a short vacation. They had come to see Rosslyn Chapel before going back to Paris. It was late evening, and the chapel was closed, but they were still inside.
"Can we go home, Grandpère?"
Sophie begged, feeling tired.
"Soon, honey, very soon."
His voice was melancholy.
"I have one last thing I need to do here. How about if you wait in the car?" "You're doing another big person thing?"
He nodded.
"I'll be fast, I promise." "Can I do the archway code again? That was fun." "I don't know, I have to step outside. You won't be frightened in here alone?" "Of course not," she said with a huff. "It's not even dark yet."
He smiled.
"Very well, then."
He led her over to the elaborate archway he had shown her earlier. Sophie immediately plopped down on the stone floor, lying on her back and staring up at the collage of puzzle pieces overhead.
"I'm going to break this code before you get back."
"It's a race, then."
He bent over, kissed her forehead, and walked to the nearby side door.
"I'll be right outside. I'll leave the door open. If you need me, just call."
He exited into the soft evening light. Sophie lay there on the floor, gazing up at the code. Her eyes felt sleepy. After a few minutes, the symbols got fuzzy, and then they disappeared. When Sophie awoke, the floor felt cold.
"Grandpère?"
There was no answer. Standing up, she brushed herself off. The side door was still open. The evening was getting darker. She could hear crickets. She walked outside, and she could see her grandfather standing on the porch of a nearby stone house directly behind the church. Her grandfather was talking quietly to a person barely visible inside the screened door.
"Grandpère,"
she called. Her grandfather turned and waved, motioning for her to wait just a moment. Then slowly, he said some final words to the person inside and blew a kiss toward the screened door. He came to her with tearful eyes.
"Why are you crying, Grandpère?"
He picked her up and held her close.
"Oh, Sophie, you and I have said goodbye to a lot of people this year. It's hard."
Sophie thought of the accident, of saying goodbye to her mother and father, her grandmother and baby brother.
"Were you saying goodbye to another person?"
"To a dear friend, whom I love very much,"
he replied, his voice heavy with emotion.
"And I fear I will not see her again for a very long time."
Standing with the docent, Langdon had been scanning the chapel walls and feeling a rising wariness that a dead end might be looming. Sophie had wandered off to look at the code and left Langdon holding the rosewood box, which contained a Grail map that now appeared to be no help at all. Although Sonnier's poem clearly indicated Rosslyn, Langdon was not sure what to do now that they had arrived. The poem made reference to a blade and chalice, which Langdon saw nowhere. "The Holy Grail neath ancient Rosslyn waits, the blade and chalice guarding o'er her gates. Again, Langdon sensed there remained some facet of this mystery yet to reveal itself.
"I hate to pry," the docent said, eyeing the rosewood box in Langdon's hands. "But this box, might I ask where you got it?"
Langdon gave a weary laugh. "That's an exceptionally long story." The young man hesitated, his eyes on the box again.
"It's the strangest thing. My grandmother has a box exactly like that. A jewelry box. Identical polished rosewood, same inlaid rose. Even the hinges look the same."
Langdon knew the young man must be mistaken. If ever a box had been one of a kind, it was this one. The box custom-made for the Priory Keystone. The two boxes may be similar, but... The side door closed loudly, drawing both of their gazes. Sophie had exited without a word and was now wandering down the bluff toward a fieldstone house nearby. Langdon stared after her. Where is she going? She'd been acting strangely ever since they entered the building. He turned to the docent. Do you know what that house is? He nodded, also looking puzzled that Sophie was going down there.
That's the chapel rectory. The curator lives there. She also happens to be the head of the Rosslyn Trust.
He paused.
And my grandmother.
Your grandmother is the head of the Rosslyn Trust? The young man nodded.
She lives in the rectory. I live with her, and I help keep up the place and give tours.
He shrugged.
I've lived here my whole life. My grandmother raised me in that house.
Concerned for Sophie, Langdon moved across the chapel toward the door to call out to her. He was only halfway there when he stopped short. Something the young man said just registered.
My grandmother raised me.
Langdon looked out at Sophie on the bluff, then down at the rosewood box in his hand.
Impossible.
Slowly, Langdon turned back to the young man. Your grandmother's rosewood box. Where did she get it?
My grandfather made it for her. He died when I was a baby, but my grandmother still talks about him. She says he was a genius with his hands. He made all kinds of things.
Langdon glimpsed an unimaginable web of connections emerging from the ether. You said your grandmother raised you? Do you mind my asking what happened to your parents? The young man looked surprised.
They died when I was young, he paused. The same day as my grandfather.
Langdon's heart pounded. In a car accident? The boy recoiled, a look of bewilderment in his olive green eyes.
Yes, in a car accident. My entire family died that day. I lost my grandfather, my parents, and...
He hesitated, glancing down at the floor. And your sister, Langdon said. Out on the bluff, the fieldstone house was exactly as Sophie remembered it. Night was falling now, and the house exuded a warm and inviting aura. The smell of bread wafted through the opened screen door, and a golden light shone in the windows. As Sophie approached, she could hear the quiet sounds of sobbing from within. Through the screened door, Sophie saw an elderly woman in the hallway. Her back was to the door, but Sophie could see she was crying. The woman had long, luxuriant, silver hair that conjured an unexpected wisp of memory. Feeling herself drawn closer, Sophie stepped onto the porch stairs. The woman was clutching a framed photograph of a man and touching her fingertips with loving sadness to his face. It was a face Sophie knew well.
Grand-père.
The woman had obviously heard the sad news of his death last night. A board squeaked beneath Sophie's feet, and the woman turned slowly, her sad eyes finding Sophie's. Sophie wanted to run, but she stood transfixed. The woman's fervent gaze never wavered as she set down the photo and approached the screen door. An eternity seemed to pass as the two women stared at one another through the thin mesh. Then, like the slowly gathering swell of an ocean wave, the woman's visage transformed from one of uncertainty to disbelief to hope and finally to cresting joy. Throwing open the door, she came out, reaching with soft hands, cradling Sophie's thunderstruck face.
Oh, dear child, look at you.
Although Sophie did not recognize her, she knew who this woman was. She tried to speak, but found she could not even breathe.
Sophie,
the woman sobbed, kissing her forehead. Sophie's words were a choked whisper.
But grandpère said you were... I know.
The woman placed her tender hands on Sophie's shoulders and gazed at her with familiar eyes.
Your grandfather and I were forced to say so many things. We did what we thought was right. I'm so sorry. It was for your own safety, princess.
Sophie heard her final word and immediately thought of her grandfather, who had called her princess for so many years. The sound of his voice seemed to echo now in the ancient stones of Roslyn, settling through the earth and reverberating in the unknown hollows below. The woman threw her arms around Sophie now, the tears flowing faster.
Your grandfather wanted so badly to tell you everything, but things were difficult between you two. He tried so hard. There is so much to explain, so very much to explain.
She kissed Sophie's forehead once again, then whispered in her ear.
No more secrets, princess. It's time you learned the truth about our family.
Sophie and her grandmother were seated on the porch stairs in a tearful hug when the young docent dashed across the lawn, his eyes shining with hope and disbelief.
Sophie!
Through her tears, Sophie nodded, standing. She did not know the young man's face, but as they embraced, she could feel the power of the ancient blood coursing through his veins, the blood she now understood they shared. When Langdon walked across the lawn to join them, Sophie could not imagine that only yesterday she had felt so alone in the world, and now, somehow in this foreign place, in the company of three people she barely knew, she felt at last that she was home. Chapter 105. Night had fallen over Roslyn. Robert Langdon stood alone on the porch of the Fieldstone house, enjoying the sounds of laughter and reunion drifting through the screened door behind him. The mug of potent Scottish coffee in his hand had granted him a hazy reprieve from his mounting exhaustion, and yet he sensed the reprieve would be fleeting. The fatigue in his body went to the core.
"You slipped out quietly,"
a voice behind him said. He turned. Sophie's grandmother emerged, her silver hair shimmering in the night. Her name, for the last 30 years at least, was Marie Chauvel. Langdon gave a tired smile. "I thought I'd give your family some time together." Through the window, he could see Sophie talking with her brother. Marie came over and stood beside him.
"Mr. Langdon, when I first heard of Jacques' murder, I was terrified for Sophie's safety. Seeing her standing in my doorway tonight was the greatest relief of my life. I cannot thank you enough."
Langdon had no idea how to respond. Although he had offered to give Sophie and her grandmother time to talk in private, Marie had asked him to stay and listen.
"My husband obviously trusted you, Mr. Langdon. So I do as well."
The story she told about Sophie's late parents was astonishing. They had both been Merovingians, direct descendants of Mary Magdalene and Jesus Christ. Their children represented the most direct surviving royal bloodline, and therefore were carefully guarded by the priory. When Sophie's parents were killed in a car accident whose cause could not be determined, the priory feared the identity of the royal line had been discovered.
"Your grandfather and I,"
Marie had explained in a voice choked with pain,
"had to make a grave decision the instant we received the phone call. Your parents' car had just been found in the river."
She dabbed at the tears in her eyes.
"All six of us, including you two grandchildren, were supposed to be traveling together in that car that very night. Fortunately, we changed our plans at the last moment, and your parents were alone. Hearing of the accident, Jacques and I had no way to know what had really happened, or if this was truly an accident."
Marie looked at Sophie.
We knew we had to protect our grandchildren, and we did what we thought was best. Jacques reported to the police that your brother and I had been in the car. Our two bodies apparently washed off in the current. Then your brother and I went underground with the Priory. Jacques, being a man of prominence, did not have the luxury of disappearing. It only made sense that Sophie would stay in Paris to be taught and raised by Jacques, close to the heart and protection of the Priory.
Her voice fell to a whisper.
Separating the family was the hardest thing we ever had to do. Jacques and I saw each other only very infrequently, and always in the most secret of settings, under the protection of the Priory. There are certain ceremonies to which the Brotherhood always stays faithful.
Langdon had sensed the story went far deeper, but he also sensed it was not for him to hear. So he had stepped outside. Now, gazing up at the spires of Rosslyn, Langdon could not escape the hollow gnaw of Rosslyn's unsolved mystery. Is the Grail really here at Rosslyn? And if so, where are the blade and chalice that Sonnier mentioned in his poem?
I'll take that,
Marie said, motioning to Langdon's hand. Oh, thank you. Langdon held out his empty coffee cup. She stared at him.
I was referring to your other hand, Mr. Langdon.
Langdon looked down and realized he was holding Sonnier's parchment. He had taken it from the cryptex once again in hopes of seeing something he had missed earlier. Of course. I'm sorry. Marie looked amused as she took the paper.
I know of a man at a bank in Paris who is probably very eager to see the return of this rosewood box. André Vernet was a dear friend of Jacques, and Jacques trusted him explicitly. André would have done anything to honor Jacques's request for the care of this box.
Including shooting me, Langdon recalled, deciding not to mention that he had probably broken the poor man's nose. Thinking of Paris, Langdon flashed on the three Seneschaux who had been killed the night before. And the Priory. What happens now?
The wheels are already in motion, Mr. Langdon. The Brotherhood has endured for centuries, and it will endure this. There are always those waiting to move up and rebuild.
All evening, Langdon had suspected that Sophie's grandmother was closely tied to the operations of the Priory. After all, the Priory had always had women members. Four Grand Masters had been women. The Seneschaux were traditionally men, the guardians, and yet women held far more honored status within the Priory, and could ascend to the highest post from virtually any rank. Langdon thought of Lee Teabing and Westminster Abbey. It seemed a lifetime ago. Was the church pressuring your husband not to release the Sangreal documents at the end of days?
Heavens, no. The end of days is a legend of paranoid minds. There is nothing in the Priory doctrine that identifies a date at which the Grail should be unveiled. In fact, the Priory has always maintained that the Grail should never be unveiled.
Never? Langdon was stunned.
It is the mystery and wonder that serve our souls, not the Grail itself. The beauty of the Grail lies in her ethereal nature.
Marie Chauvel gazed up at Rosslyn now.
For some, the Grail is a chalice that will bring them everlasting life. For others, it is the quest for lost documents and secret history. And for most, I suspect the Holy Grail is simply a grand idea, a glorious, unattainable treasure that somehow, even in today's world of chaos, inspires us.
But if the Sangreal documents remain hidden, the story of Mary Magdalene will be lost forever, Langdon said.
Will it? Look around you. Her story is being told in art, music, and books, more so every day. The pendulum is swinging. We are starting to sense the dangers of our history and of our destructive paths. We are beginning to sense the need to restore the sacred feminine.
She paused.
You mentioned you are writing a manuscript about the symbols of the sacred feminine, are you not?
I am. She smiled.
Finish it, Mr. Langdon.
sing her song. The world needs troubadour.
Langdon fell silent, feeling the weight of her message upon him. Across the open spaces, a new moon was rising above the tree line. Turning